judicial independence. Magnitsky once worked at Russia's largest Western investment fund and claimed to have uncovered a scheme used by officials to reclaim about $235 million in taxes paid by his firm. He was arrested by the same officials he accused of tax fraud. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
In Los Angeles, it was dubbed Carmageddon, but fears of a massive gridlock never materialized with the weekend closing of the 405 freeway. This morning, commuters are again on the busy roadway as work crews completed repairs a day early. Space Shuttle Atlantis is packing up for the last trip home from the International Space Station. Today, astronauts are stowing a large container of trash for the trip back to Earth. The school bus-sized container is filled with packing material and other space station debris. On Earth, that high-tech trash can would weigh 3 tons. I'm Jim Howard, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Visa, whose Visa Signature credit card offers access to the movies this summer. Details at fandango.com/visa-signature.
AM 580 thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
Good morning. This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have, again, on the program, Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And monthly, he's here on the program. It's always on Monday, and we take questions on home maintenance. So whatever's on your mind, maybe you got a problem, needs to be fixed. You're thinking of making some changes, doing some remodeling, any and all of that. He knows a lot about all the various pieces and parts of the single-family home. So whatever the problem might be, just give us a call and tell us about it, and he'll see if he can help you out. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. So it would be free for you if it's a long-distance call. That's 800-222-9455. We can also take emails if you want to do that, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you got questions, you can give us a call. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, David. Last month you snuck out on me, so I haven't seen you in for a month.
Yeah, that's
so.
Right. I was thinking it'd been a while since I had seen you. Yeah, I was taking a little time to visit my dad. That was Father's Day, so I always do that. I'm glad to be back and glad to have you here. I don't know if there's anything in particular you want to talk about.
Well, I was going to do a little bit on air conditioning today since, of course, we have this oppressingly hot heat wave going through here.
Yeah.
What I ran across the other day, what I thought was interesting, is somebody had their fan in the on position on their air conditioner, saying that it helps circulate the air in the house, which sounds really nice, like a good idea, particularly if you've got a two-story house, it helps to circulate the air top to bottom, things like that. However, on days like this, probably would not put that on the on position, but more the auto position. If the fan is blowing while the compressor is not running, we end up tending to re-evaporate some of the moisture that was collecting on the condenser, and we end up putting moisture back in the house. So the house will cool down, but it's not going to feel comfortable because the humidity level is going to be high. Let's face it, here in Central Illinois, I've mentioned it before, an air conditioner is more of a dehumidification system than a real cooling system. We're only moving air that is about, 12 to 15 degrees cooler than what the intake air is. But the point is that it's drying it, and 80 degrees and being dry in the house is much more comfortable than, say, 77 or 78 degrees and being humid in the house. So make sure you've got that air conditioner on, but in the auto position, not in the fan position or the fan on position, because we don't want to keep blowing all that moisture back inside the house.
Yeah. I'm sure there are a lot of people, too, that, they're trying to save money on their power bills, and they say, well, I'm not home during the daytime, so it doesn't really have to be cool. So we're really going to push the setting up. We'll set it at 80. We'll set it at, it doesn't matter because I'm going to say, well, I'm not here, so why cool the house while I'm not here?
Well, I don't mind setting it up a few degrees, but in the air conditioning season, anything more than about 4 degrees, 3 to 4 degrees, what happens is, again, the moisture, the humidity comes into the house. And so when you do turn your air conditioner back on, yes, it'll cool the house back down, but the moisture level is still high, so it's not really a comfortable temperature. Mm-hmm. So leaving it within about 3 or 4 degrees of your normal comfort zone will let it run enough to keep the humidity levels controlled in the house. So when you go to turn it back down, then when it does cool down, the house feels a lot more comfortable, a lot more livable, not quite as muggy. One of the One of my more amusing stories on air conditioners, my buddy called up and said, hey, I finally put central air conditioning in my house. I'm like, really? Where'd you run the condensate drain? He said, oh, I just put it into a bucket. Called me up 3 days later. It turned out the bucket was a 55-gallon garbage can, and he called me up and says, Scott, how do I get this 55-gallon of water out of my basement? Because he hadn't had an air conditioner running for some time. In 3 days, he managed to pick up about 30 or 35 gallons of water that was moisture that was in the house that has condensed out. Of course, that at the weight of water per pound, he was not able to lift the garbage can to get it back outside. So we had to get a pump and drop it in the garbage can and pump it outside so that he could empty his condensate drain. And I'm like, well, you might want to consider putting in a regular condensate pump or run it to a plumbing drain or something rather than have to put it into this big garbage can, which he assumed that he could just empty every
just,
once a week or something
really
like that.
He just thought that there would be not that much, and could just empty it by hand.
And it's just absolutely amazing how much moisture that air conditioner will pull out on days like today.
Yeah. Are there many people who wouldn't have some kind of a floor drain or some place in their – wherever it is, I guess probably most people would be in their basement, but no place – that they could just drain the condensate?
Depending on the age of the house. Almost everything that's been built in like last 10 or 15 years, they do put some type of floor drain in the utility room so that they can run the temperature pressure relief valve from the water heater, things like that, to a floor drain, which is going into the sanitary sewers. We start getting into houses a little bit older than that. And usually what they did was ran it down to a crawl space and then outside, or if it was in a basement, they would try and run it to a floor drain in the basement. But I still get into houses where, particularly crawl space houses, where they just take the condensate drain and stick it right through the floor and let it drip into the crawl space. Well, the crawl space is still part of our proverbial moisture balloon, and that moisture just stays in the house. Yeah. Water, once it becomes a water vapor, moves by vapor pressure, not airflow. So if you were to picture a balloon and put a drop of water in the bottom of the balloon, when the drop of water evaporates, it hasn't left. It's still there. But now the water is evenly distributed around the balloon, so we end up with the same moisture level, same humidity level everywhere inside the balloon. Well, the vapor barrier in a crawl space, a floor in a basement, that's all part of our balloon. So if we've got water there, once it evaporates, it comes up through the house. Vapor pressure will move that moisture through floors, doors, walls, everything except a vapor barrier such as glass or plastic, something like that. So what happens is that condensate drain goes into the crawl space, sits on top of the plastic, re-evaporates, come back in the house, and gets pulled back out by the air conditioner, dropped back down into the crawl space, and we just have a recirculation system and not really getting it out. So I do not recommend just dumping it down into the crawl space. I like to see either a little pump to pump it out or run it to a drain line or even outside. If you can run it out through a crawl space vent or run it out through a basement window to your favorite little rose bush out there, it will get – every time it gets hot and muggy, it'll have a source of plenty of water, nice cool water to keep the plant happy.
Okay. We got a caller here in Champaign. We'll talk with them. Line one. Hello?
Yes, hello. I've got two questions now based on your first answer, your answer you just got. I have a condensate line for my air conditioner that runs into a French drain in the crawl space. It's about a 40-gallon barrel with holes punched in the bottom. It's all covered with Visqueen. It's been that way since the house was built, but... I guess from what you just said, you wouldn't recommend doing that.
Well, I don't recommend it. A lot will depend on that situation, what type of soil the house is on. If your quote-unquote French drain, if your little bucket that you've got in there actually works, then that should be sufficient as long as you've got it covered with the vapor barrier so it's outside of that moisture, yeah. That balloon theory. The problem we run into is that most of the houses in this area, at least in the Champaign-Urbana area, we have such a clay content here that you can dig a hole that big and fill it with gravel, but it's still going to be a bucket because the clay doesn't let that water go out.
I do have a lot of clay in my area. I never thought about it. I guess I'd crawl down there and see if it's draining properly.
Yeah, after it's been running for a day like today, go down there and see if there's some water standing underneath that plastic. And if there's some standing water, then we probably ought to see about trying to get it outside. The vapor barrier, if it's properly installed, is preventing that moisture from coming into the house. It is on the outside of our balloon, so it's not as big an issue. But, of course, standing water underneath the plastic does tend to lead to mold and mildew issues as well.
This is probably about a 50-gallon barrel sunk down in the ground, and Mm-hmm. That's interesting enough. It didn't have holes punched in the bottom. I discovered that, punched holes in the bottom. But
okay.
My other question is that we're doing a kitchen remodeling project, and we're considering using granite countertops. And I'm kind of partial to a cast iron sink versus stainless steel. And I was thinking that's going to be pretty heavy. I don't know how they typically tie that into granite. You know, with wood, it's pretty straightforward. Like we have laminate, they just screw it up. You know, it's just gravity mount on top. But I'm thinking that might be too heavy for a granite countertop.
Usually the stone, because most sinks these days are about the same size as your kitchen base cabinet, there is really little pressure in the middle of the stone. Yes, if we were going to hang it and have a 10 or 12-inch section of stone unsupported, then try and hang the cast iron sink off of it, that could be a leverage point where, yes, it could be hard on the granite. But once you get your sink in and it's in a base cabinet, you've only got about 1 inch or 2 inches perimeter. You haven't got enough leverage to break the stone. The granite countertops are still pretty thick. So they use a clamping system. They'll set the sink on there, and then they'll run a clamp up there and basically pinch it to the stone.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. I was just curious about that because it's not as strong as wood, certainly.
It can be fairly strong, but it does have fracture points in it. Granite does, you know, if you hit it just right, it will break. But I don't think just a constant load like that with, like, say, a short overhang or a short unsupported area should be a problem. If you were going to put a little bar sink in a great big huge cabinet, then that might be a different story because we've got so much space between where the sink is and where the countertop is actually supported by the cabinet. But
since it's an undermount, then that was the question, how they're going to – they're not going to screw it up into the – stone, I don't think. They must use some brackets of some kind.
And they can put an anchor into the stone to help hold it, and it will work.
Okay, we're good. Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you for calling.
Thank you. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program once a month. It's always a Monday, and we talk about home maintenance issues. So if you have a problem or you have a question, give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, so it would be a free call if it would be long distance for you. It's on us, and that's 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@ illinois.edu. I just thought I'd ask generally about this time of year when it is really hot. I think a lot of people, and maybe people like live in an older house like I do, and one of the issues on our house is that there is no air return in the upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets kind of warm.
Yeah,
in the upstairs because we have air conditioning and we have the vents set up, I think, doing a pretty good job putting the cool air up there. But also, of course, the issue is the hot air just goes up there by itself. And is there anything that you could suggest other than just making sure you got your ducts balanced?
It's a matter of balancing the heating and cooling system so that you can actually force more air to the upper floor to let it fall down. And, yeah, an older house, particularly one that's been retrofitted with an air conditioning system, it is harder to cool an upper level. Your heat registers are generally in the floor. On new constructions, what we'll do now is we'll put our heat registers in the ceiling on the second floor so that the cold air starts at the ceiling and comes down. The use of ceiling fans to help circulate the air on the upper floors so that the cold air that you're putting in at the floor does tend to circulate up through the room, doesn't stratify at the floor, and then just fall back down the stairs. A doorway on the stairs so that you can close off the second floor so you can put the cold air up there and it doesn't run down. If you've got large open stairways, yeah, it's pretty difficult to do. In extreme cases, we have put in an air recirculation system where we basically put a duct on the first floor that we can pull air from and a duct up on the second floor that we can blow. And sort of like turning the fan on your air conditioning system, but not have it go through the air conditioning system. Just draw the cool air from the first floor and redistribute it back up to the second floor, which only works well if you happen to have a nice chase or closet or something. You can run that duct up to it, but that does help reduce the stratification that you get with a multi-story house.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I've got a bunch of calls now, and in fact, the lines are full, so we'll get right to it, and we'll start with someone in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about dehumidifying a basement. I am currently finishing some areas of my basement. It's about 1,100 square feet. You know, researched online, you know, X dehumidifier can cover, you know, 1,100 square feet. Do I need to think through that anymore in terms of, well, there are sort of three or four different rooms, and maybe there's the best location for a dehumidifier. I'll run it into a sump pump that'll take it outside. Are there any other strategies or things I can think about in terms of dehumidifying my basement and not wanting, you know, the wood to rot or that type of thing as I finish it?
Okay, well, wood rotting, of course, takes a lot of moisture, and we can get some condensation in a basement because it generally is one of the cooler areas of the house. But as my earlier comments on moisture, water does move by vapor pressure once it's evaporated. So putting a dehumidifier anywhere in the basement creates a low vapor pressure in that area, and so the moisture that's in the basement, the moisture that's in the first floor, moisture that's in the attic, all wants to move to that area.
Right.
So really, location, as long as it's not a room that's sealed in plastic, you're in pretty good shape.
Right.
You can put it just about anywhere. The sump pump room, in my opinion, makes a very good sense because we can, first of all, it's usually a room that we can close off so we don't have to listen to it run. We don't have to empty it because it drains into the sump pump.
Right.
It will pull moisture not only from that room, but as it pulls moisture from that room, all the rest of the high levels of moisture will want to move to there. So,
right.
Yeah, a dehumidifier in the attic will help dry out a basement.
Okay.
Where you put it really doesn't matter. The tighter the house is, the more effective it will be. They say, okay, hey, this one's good for 1,100 square feet. Well, that's assuming a certain amount of air leakage in the house, and the tighter your house is, it may be able to dehumidify a larger area. An older house that has a lot of air movement, you may need to get a second one because it may not be able to handle that big an area.
Right, and there's no argument for an air conditioner in the basement for dehumidification purposes, is there?
No, actually, the basement really needs very little air conditioning. The dehumidifier... the experiment I did on my home was to turn on the air conditioner, and with the air conditioner alone, the house was comfortable at about 75, 74 degrees. With an air conditioner and a dehumidifier running in the lower level, I was actually able to turn the air conditioning system up to 77 or 78 and be comfortable because the dehumidifier helped pull that humidity out, so I was more comfortable even at a warmer temperature.
Right. And will I be expecting the dehumidifier to use substantially less energy than an air conditioner would?
Well, it does have a compressor in it similar to an air conditioner, so they do use a little bit more, you know, about like a refrigerator or something like that. So I will say it's one of the higher energy users in the house.
Right.
It doesn't use as much as an air conditioner system.
Okay. Thank you so much for your advice.
All right. Very good. We'll move on. And this is also someone in Urbana, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I recently had a friend stay at my house for a week, and he had a serious allergic reaction that he claimed to be mold-related.
Okay.
How do I find out if I have mold? From the searching that I've been able to do, I'm supposed to find a certified professional, but nobody tells me what that means or certified in what.
Okay. I have recommended in the past a company here in town that can do air quality testing. They put in some canisters in your house for a couple of days, collect some air samples, and then basically try and grow petri dishes of whatever mold contents are there to determine how much mold, what type of mold, and things like that. And they are local here. It's HDC Labs. I don't know the cost on such a thing, but if somebody said that you have a mold problem, it's a good thing to do is to have these air samples taken and actually determine what is air.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for calling.
Okay. Well, hope that helps. And we'll go to next line number four. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Yes, hello, sir. Thanks very much for offering this service.
Sure.
My question is, I live here in Urbana in a pretty small two-bedroom condo on a concrete slab, and I'll be going away actually out of the country for a year, and we'll be leaving the house vacant.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask what you recommend about turning the water off and or turning off the gas heating. I was told by a plumber that maybe it would be actually almost impossible to guarantee getting out all of the water by having a plumber flush out the lines. So maybe I might be best off just leaving the heat on and the water on, or turning the water off but leaving the heat on, and turning the thermostat down to something like 45 degrees or something while I'm gone. Do you have any recommendations there as to what I should do to button up the home, get it winter ready?
Well, I'm going to have to agree with your plumber in that with the concrete slab home, you've got water lines in the slab. And while in most homes we can winterize where we go to the lowest section of the house, open a line, we then blow air through it, we can get most of the water out. But with a concrete slab, it's almost impossible because you can't get lower than the slab to get the water lines to drain out. So okay. You'll end up with a pocket. I also don't like leaving slab houses unheated completely in that we can get some frost heave. If the house does get extremely cold, which it will if you don't have any heat on whatsoever, we can actually freeze or expand the soil underneath the slab that hasn't expanded since the house was built, and we can get a lot of cracks in the slab. We can actually lift part of the floors.
Okay.
So I really do not recommend leaving a slab house completely unheated.
So what you recommend I leave the thermostat at if I do leave the heat on?
You should be all right in the 45 to 50 degree range. What I would do is take a couple of windows that aren't used on a regular basis and maybe put some styrofoam or something over them so that we don't have any excess heat loss.
Okay.
I mean, you can block them up pretty good so the temperature stays fairly easily. The concrete slab will try and stay about 50 or 55 degrees year-round, even without heat. But on really cold days, particularly if some air is getting through the house, it will drop the temperature and we could cause some freezing problems.
And so, do I need to close up my dryer vent also?
I would put something over the top of it or disconnect it and stuff a towel in it because, yes, that is one area where air can come back into the house. And, again, we're trying to heat it as economically as possible because you're not going to be there. So closing up a lot of little air holes and stuff like that for areas that would normally be open, putting a piece of plastic around the grill for the kitchen vent fan, something like that so that air doesn't move through it.
Okay. And then the last thing I was wondering, since you obviously know so much about this, I've read that maybe I should pour RV antifreeze down the toilet. Do I want to do that with all of the traps in the house, like the various sinks and the shower?
Yes, if you're going to go away for that long, yes, I would turn off the water at the main water supply.
Right, yeah.
I would try and drain all the toilet tanks and such. And then, yes, you can buy this RV antifreeze for water systems, which is it's an antifreeze theoretically safe to drink. Not necessarily appetizing, but at least it's not harmful, that you can pour a little bit into the tanks because it's almost impossible to get everything out of every trap. And so, you know, 5 or 6 gallons of that stuff around the house in different sink traps will help prevent, you know, if something does happen where we can't keep the house truly at 40 or 45 degrees, then at least we don't come home to a bunch of broken porcelain and cracked drains. Yes. And don't forget to turn the gas off to the water heater once you turn the water off, because the last thing we want is for the water heater to ask for warm water and not have any water in it, and the burner just sit there and run and trying to heat the water heater that's empty.
Right. Okay. Will do. Thank you so much.
All right. Very good. Thank you. On again to other callers. Our guest, by the way, in this hour of focus, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month, always on a Monday to answer these kind of questions. So if you've got a problem, you need some help, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Back to the phones. Georgetown next, line one.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was outside and I came in. So I hate to ask this, but if you'd repeat, I think somebody called in about how you would check mold in a basement, if there was some way you can check it. I mean, I know you can have an inspector come in, but is there something you can do yourself? I didn't catch that. Then my other question is, on the countertops, there's the Corian, there is granite, and now there is, I believe, something else that's, I don't know what it's called, and I just was wondering if you could give me the pros and cons of each. And I don't know if you know what that third one is. I can't think of the name of it. I think it's supposedly very similar to granite or Corian, but it's much less expensive. And are you familiar with that?
I will have to admit I am not an expert on the kitchen countertops.
Okay.
That's something that is – they're always coming out with a newer, better, greater, best type deal.
Okay.
I do kind of get amused by the progression over the decades of what we have used for kitchen countertops and how the Formica was the great thing with the little boomerang pattern, and then it went away for solid colors. And then the next thing I know, the little boomerang pattern comes back and is in style again. Now it's the granite and other different types of countertops, a Corian. The Corian is a plastic that is colored all the way through, so it doesn't wear like Formica countertops. You know, you rub them in several spots. You can actually wear through the top coat, where the Corian, that doesn't that doesn't happen.
And the granite, are there, what are, I mean, it's quite expensive. What are there disadvantages of that, or what are the big advantages of it?
Once the granite is sealed so that nothing gets in it, it is a very durable, long-life material.
But does it have to be sealed regularly then?
I do not know the the intervals on that. I haven't built a kitchen in a while, so I know what's out there, but I really haven't done the investigation on it.
Okay, fine. Thank you. And then the mold, if there's some way that you as a homeowner can check mold without having somebody...
I am not familiar of a do-it-yourself mold kit most of the time, because in order to actually check the air quality, then we have to grow a sample, basically a Petri dish of the mold to find out, to get enough of it to actually test it. So it is something that it does require a lab or some type of...
So is that what you do? You have somebody come in, take some of the air?
Yes, they do an air sample test, and then they go back and try and determine what was in the air, what airborne particles you have, to determine what kind of a mold content you've got.
Okay, and are they listed in the phone book, or how do you find about them?
I've always used a company here in town called HDC Labs.
HDC.
Correct.
Okay. Alrighty, thank you so much.
All right, thank you for calling in.
I'm sure that the tough thing about mold is that it could very well be, maybe likely is, in some place that you can't see. So you don't you can't just look at it and see where it is. It's probably going to be, unless it's on the walls in your basement, it's probably inside the walls someplace.
Right, and I will have to admit, I'm not the sky is falling type person. I don't get all panicky when somebody says mold. Okay, you have to take into account that there are more types of mold than there are people. Mold has been around since before man. Not all of it is bad. Penicillin is a mold. You end up, if you have aged beef, they mold, get mold on it and get the mold into the beef to give it the flavor. So not all mold is bad. So when somebody says, oh, I have mold in my house, it's like, well, yeah, probably. Is it a hazardous mold? Probably not. In large quantities, anything is not good for you. Let's face it, we're made up 90% of water, but we can still drown. In large enough quantities, nothing is really good for you. So large quantities of mold is not a good idea. Very rarely do we end up with any really nasty strains of molds. I don't know the scientific ones, though. Everybody said black mold. Well, most mold will turn black once it starts drying out. So to say black mold is bad is a generalization that just doesn't hold water. If you think you've got excess mold, that means you've probably got a moisture problem somewhere. If we've got a moisture problem, let's take care of the moisture problem, and that will help prevent the mold from growing. If it's a condensation issue, or if it's a slow leak inside a wall, we need to find the source of the moisture. Houses that are closed up without any air conditioning, without any dehumidifiers, they can also end up with a lot of mold in the lower levels just because of the amount of humidity. We're making houses tighter and tighter nowadays than what we used to, so we don't have as much air moving through them. So now we have to really worry about how much moisture and humidity we put in them. So air samples, air quality testing is about the only way to determine exactly what type of mold and to what extent. I personally keep a little bottle of mold cleaner around, and when I see a little bit, you wipe it off and it comes back regularly. That means we got a moisture source. Go find it, figure that out, and then worry about how much mold we've got.
Okay. Well, we got several callers here. We'll get right on to some callers in a moment. We're talking this morning with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service, and we'll talk some more about home maintenance after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
And this is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. We're here weekday mornings, and we have different topics every day. In the second hour today, our guest is Justin Martin. He's a writer, biographer. He's produced a new biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, the man who many people will know as the guy who designed Central Park and a lot of other parks. He was quite an interesting man, one of the most influential Americans of the 19th century, and we'll find out more about him in hour number two. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is William Holst. He is a journalist, and we will talk about his book, The Next American Economy, Blueprint for a Real Recovery. And then in the second hour tomorrow, the topic is cybersecurity, and we'll talk with Brad Schaaf, who is part of the security team at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You can find out what we're doing for the rest of the week and next week by going to our website. That way you can also listen to past shows you might have missed. It's all at will.illinois, that's W-I-L-L. WILL.illinois.edu. This is the morning we do home care on the show. We do it once a month. It's always a Monday. Our guest is Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And we have a number of callers here, and we'll get back into it. And next person is in Champaign County, and that's line number two. Hello.
Apropos your last discussion, I guess we have a lot of new experts on mold, since with the foreclosure crisis and all these empty houses, it's kind of epidemic, I guess. But I wondered, you mentioned something about the fixed temperature between the input and the output of an air conditioner. It reminds me that you once explained what was about, and I'm interested in it because I want to assess a couple of different room air conditioners to see I can tell about how well they're working and that kind of thing.
An individual room air conditioner is not rated the same as a whole house or a central air conditioner system. Room air conditioners are because we're blowing the air to the outside and we're not running it, we're not doing a return air, we're not drawing it back through. They're going to have a much higher temperature drop. The exact number, I'm not sure. Usually when I measure a room air conditioner, it's putting out 50 to 55 degree air. Whereas a central air conditioner, if it's 75 in the house, I don't want it blowing more than about 62 or 63 degree air. If it starts blowing too cold, then usually we end up with a overcooling, telling me we're not moving enough air. Things like that. So a room air conditioner, basically, it should be blowing a lot colder than the 15 degrees or 12 degrees that I look for in a central air.
Well, what would you suggest about how to assess how well it's a couple of different ones are working, I guess?
Put a thermometer right directly.
See how well they work, I guess.
Yeah, put a thermometer directly in the unit and see what kind of a temperature you're getting. Like I say, on a room air conditioner, a standalone unit like that, usually I look for at least a 50 or 55 degree temperature coming out of it. There's no good way of measuring what the return is.
I've got a clamp meter, and I was thinking about looking to see how many amps are being used. Do you think there's any utility to
doing that? Well, that'll tell you how efficient the unit is and how much power it's using. And I will say that window air conditioners do use more power than a central air conditioning system. And it's one of those things, okay, how many window units do we have? How big an electrical service do we have to the house? How cost effective would it be to put in a full central air system, whether or not you've got duct work, whether or not the house is heated with hot water and has no duct system? I mean, there's several different factors on that. But yeah, the newer air conditioners, in the last 15 years, there have been great strides made in the efficiency of air conditioners. So if you've got an air conditioner that's probably more than about 15 years old, my guess is you can reduce the energy use almost in half by replacing it on a window unit. It almost holds true on the central air units. The central air units have gotten a lot more efficient as well.
What is the SEER rating for a high-quality central system nowadays?
You can get pretty high, almost up to 18. The SEER rating being the seasonal energy efficiency rating, which is the number of BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. I believe right now you're not allowed to install one less than a 13, and whereas one that was built, say, 15 years ago was probably a 6 or an 8. So we are, like I say, making air conditioners that will cool for half the cost of what they did back 15 years ago. The common ones that I see right now are in the 13 to 15 range.
So, keep cool.
All right. Thanks for the call.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Let me just review, as the caller mentioned, let me just review that we've also talked about something, an easy test anybody can do if they have central air to judge whether it's doing its job. And that's by measuring the temperature of the cold air coming out and hot air going back and seeing what the difference is.
Yeah, it's a good rule of thumb. I'm not going to say it's an absolute one way or another. Generally, if I'm doing a home inspection and I want to check and verify that the central air conditioner is in working condition, I will turn the central air conditioner on, let it run for a little while. I will put a thermometer in the return air, pull the air that it's pulling back to the system, and see how warm the house is. Generally, that temperature will match what the thermometer in the house says. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a house that is at 80 degrees and I'm reading at 80 degrees going into the return, when I put it in the supply, I look for about about a 12 to 13 degree temperature drop. So I'm not looking for air to come out of there at 55 degrees. If I get air coming out at, 67, something like that, okay, that's going to be what I consider to be working condition because it is cooling. Now, if the house is 70, yeah, it's got to come out at 58. If somebody's got a thermostat set way down, they've got the house pretty cool, it's 70 degrees in the house, yeah, I'm going to get 58 degrees out. But when I get into one that's been closed up and it's 85 in there and the thing's only blowing out 73 degree air, it's still working. It's just the house has got a residual heat in it, and it will take a while to cool it back down.
Now, and when you're picking the duct that you're going to measure your cold air coming out of, you want to pick the one that's got the shortest.
Yeah, you want to get one closest that's near to it. Yeah. If the furnace air conditioner system's in the basement, usually you can pick one above it in the kitchen area or something that's usually fairly close to it. I mean, you don't run it all the way to the far reach of the house, upstairs, back bedroom, bonus room, and trying to get a test there because it takes forever for the ductwork between where you're at and the furnace to cool down, so you're not getting a true reading of what the air conditioner is putting out. Ideally, and what the furnace guys do is they take the temperatures right at the air conditioner itself. They put a hole in the ductwork, slide a thermometer in there, and they check it across the evaporator itself. For what I do and for what most homeowners can do, if you can just take a good reading thermometer and put it on the return air, read it, put another one on a supply air near the air conditioner, read it. If you've got about a 13-degree drop, some of the older, less efficient units may be 15 degrees. If we get out to Arizona or something like that, they may want to set them up at 20 degrees, 18 degrees. But here in Illinois, to keep them running at a level where we can control the moisture, control the humidity, we usually try and go for about that 12 to 13-degree range.
Okay, very good. Well, got some other callers here. And next, we'll talk with somebody in Champaign. Line 3. Hello. Your caller there on line 3? We're having a real hard time hearing you. I'll tell you what, maybe you could try. We'll go on to another caller, and if you could, why don't you try putting the call through again, and we'll see, maybe we get a better connection next time around. With that, let's say we'll go to line number 1. This is somebody who is on a cell phone. Hello?
Good morning.
Yes.
I know it's sort of problematic, but a coating over a concrete basement floor, do you have any recommendations?
They do make several different concrete paints. They also make some fancier ones for garage floors and stuff. What kind of purpose are we looking for?
Oh, can I interject? Well, what I was really hoping for was a concrete sort of filler because this has deteriorated somewhat.
And it's in a basement or outside?
Basement.
Okay, they do make several different types of concrete leveling systems for basement floors. It's a little bit easier to do it on a basement rather than an outdoor. The freeze thaw tends to make all the thin coatings break off, but in a basement you can get a pretty good long life. A lot of it depends on the prep. You really have to clean the concrete, get as much of the loose stuff off as possible, because if you apply the coating over loose concrete, the coating has nothing better to hold on to, so it ends up pulling off. There's multiple different products out there. I don't have any one particular that I've found works any better than any other. Obviously, the ones that are the least expensive probably have the least amount of life, but that doesn't necessarily mean the ones that are most expensive are going to last the longest. So you have to do a little bit of shopping and see what kind of use you've got. If it's a high traffic area, then you want something that's a little bit thicker. If you're just trying to put carpet or something over the top of it, you can use something that's not as fine. You can use a relatively coarse material. It all depends on the application. But I will say that most of the time on the inside, we can do a patch like that. Now, if we're looking at a driveway or a sidewalk, the thin patches don't work worth a darn.
Right. Okay. You know, my follow up a little bit. Would you use phosphate and muriatic acid, or would you avoid those and just do a stiff brush type?
Well, it depends on, again, your application, where your area is, how closed up it is. When you start using the acids, you have to make sure you use a really well-ventilated area. Generally, I would say muriatic acid is a very good wash for the concrete, but not necessarily the average do-it-yourselfer. If you've got some experience handling the chemicals and stuff, that may be thing. But for the average Joe, I would probably recommend that something a little bit less acidic.
Right. Can I ask one more question, please?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. With respect to water coming, you know, welling up. These concrete coatings you're talking about, do you groove them, or, you know what I'm saying, do you worry about hydrostatic issues?
Well, hopefully we don't have a hydrostatic problem. In Champaign-Urbana area, at least, we are not known for having a water table that is that high. We do get some surface drainage, so we do end up with wet basements, but generally it's not a hydrostatic pressure pushing up from underneath. If you've got water coming up from underneath, chances are we need to put a sump pump in to relieve the pressure underneath the slab. Since water doesn't like to go uphill, if you've got someplace lower for it to drain to, such as a sump pump, it will usually go there.
This was problematic because it's got a sump pump, and it's got a little they built a sort of a super numerary sort of a pad on top of the original concrete, I think. It was built over a spring, is what somebody told me.
Okay.
Yeah. So I know we're dancing with the devil here a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're getting into some pretty specific stuff here that may be a little bit more than what we can do on a generalized show such as this. But most of the time when somebody's putting in a concrete coating, we don't necessarily have a hydrostatic problem. I have found very few basements that do have the hydrostatic issue. If you've got a water level or you're built over a clay lens or a dish that's holding water, then yes, we need to get that drained because there's almost nothing that's going to hold if you've got water coming up from underneath, pushing on it. It's just over, let's face it, water dissolves just about everything, and over time it will try and push or lift things off of there. So we need to work more on your water table issue before you do too much with the concrete, because otherwise any patch you put on is going to be temporary.
Okay, I think you sort of reinforced my thinking about the issue. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we'll go on here. We have maybe about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers, and next is Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I would like to know about the efficiency of getting an energy audit. I get these notices from the power company that says that I'm using more energy than I should be.
The energy audits are a nice idea. They're kind of interesting to find out what's going on with the house.
Mm-hmm.
You can usually do a quick look around the house yourself. Take a look in the attic. How much insulation is in the attic? Is there any openings for, say, plumbing soffit areas or kitchen soffit areas that we could fill with some insulation? Is there enough ventilation to get excess heat out? Going down in the basement or crawl space, do we have any insulation in the walls? Do we have any insulation in the band joist? When I'm doing a home inspection, I pull a cover on an electrical outlet on an outside wall and take a fine screwdriver outside of the electrical box. I am not condoning sticking screwdrivers into electrical boxes, but around the outside of the electrical box, and you can use this this fine screwdriver to feel whether or not there is any insulation inside the walls. The energy audits, there's a couple of different styles or types, and they are very effective to finding your air leaks. Sometimes they're almost too good. I mean, if you've got a house that doesn't have a lot of air leakage, trying to fill every little fine point is not necessarily going to save you much because you're not losing much. And if you're saving a little bit of what you're losing, but you weren't losing much, you're not getting a big gain out of it.
Right.
So it kind of, if they're saying that you're using more energy, then yeah, I would probably do a quick self check, attic.
Yep.
Basement, crawl space area, find a place that we can get into a wall and look in a wall. Otherwise, there's blower door tests where they can actually do air leakage tests. How much air is leaking in the house? They put in a big fan in place of your front door and turn the fan on, and they have a either an alcohol or mercury gauge that tells them what the pressure differential is for the amount of air that they're moving, how many CFM they're moving, and how what the pressure differential is inside the house versus outside the house as to how much air is actually leaking into the house. They also can do some thermal scans, which usually work better in cooler weather. Take a cute little picture with the infrared camera that shows all the hot spots and whether or not there's insulation voids in the walls.
Okay.
Things like that. So yeah, I would do a quick walkthrough yourself and say, okay, look, I could probably do this. Adding some insulation to the attic is a nice, easy, effective way of doing things. It usually doesn't cost a lot. Right. And it most of our heat does like to go up. Once you start trying to put insulation in the walls, it's a little bit more difficult. Crawl space insulation is relatively easy to do, but again, most of our heat is going up. So unless the house is really well insulated, the crawl space isn't normally my first priority.
Right.
If you've got a lack of insulation in the walls, I wouldn't go, hey, I've got to insulate my crawl space. I'd be going, let's take a look at the walls first, or let's add a little bit more in the attic area.
Gotcha.
But I do think that the energy audits do give you a very good picture of how the house is performing.
Okay. Thank you much.
All right. Thank you. Well, I got an email here, and I wanted to read it to you. It's a little complicated. I hope that we can get the caller's question in here. It's from someone who says they're considering replacing the outside door on their house. So they went to one of the local big box places and says, well, I can get an in-stock insulated door, a solid door for $119, or one, I guess, with glass in it, like with a window in it, for $288. There would be a contractor and somebody could come and put the door on. That adds another $310. So he's looking at, with that, I guess, and also must be that plus a storm door, about $1,000 to do that, do it that way. He said also he talked to a private company who said to do that same job, put on a new door and probably also new a storm door, they said $6,000. With a discount, might go down as much as $4,000. So he says, well, first of all, that's more than he can possibly do. But he's kind of wondering, well, why is it that the door itself from the big box store is so much less expensive than the door that the private contractor would come and do? So I guess he's concerned about the big difference, you know, in the price for for the doors. And whether the in-stock door would be okay for a Weller house. What would you think about going to someplace like Home Depot or Lowe's or someplace like that to buy a door?
Okay. First of all, I'd like to apologize to our email person because that is one of the voicemails that I have on my phone from Friday that I have not had a chance to call back. So I appreciate you calling in or sending in the email.
So then you've thought about this.
Yes, I have looked into that. And that was actually one of this afternoon's projects to get the voicemail box emptied out. I do not understand why a door would be $6,000. And even at $4,000, there's no good reason that I can think of that would run a door that high. There are different qualities in doors. Yes, we can buy lower end doors at the big box stores. We can spend a little bit more money on the Pella and Anderson doors. They're a little bit nicer, a little bit more durable, a little bit more energy efficient, but not a lot. Definitely not thousands of dollars worth of difference. If I have a $400,000 house, I'm probably not going to put a $100 front door in it. Because it's style-wise, it's not going to look as good. Does it perform as well? I would say they're going to be very close to performance. As long as the new doors are either a fiberglass or steel clad with a foam insulating core, and most of them have a compression or a magnetic weather strip, and as long as they're installed correctly and that somebody foams where the door frame meets the rough framing so we don't get any air leaks around the outside of it, they're going to be very, very comparable. So, no, I have thought about the question, and my answer was going to be, who in the world would want to offer $6,000? And for our other listeners, a Weller home is one of the local contractors here that built, back in the 70s, and built large tracts of houses, mostly national homes, which was a company over in Indiana that built the walls and such in jigs and shipped the walls over on a truck and basically we'll call it a modular home. They basically built the thing out of parts that were already preassembled. Mm-hmm. They went up very quickly, and there's some very large tracks here in Champaign-Urbana that were built by Weller Construction. The houses are very well designed, very solid, nicely constructed. But they were introductory level housing at the time they were built back in the, I think my, I have one myself that was built in 58. Mm-hmm. So in the, you know, the 50 to 60s and even up into the 70s. So anyway, that being said, I do not see a good reason to put in a super high dollar door, and I don't see how somebody could come up with a price of that much. That I really feel that your $1,000 estimate that you have listed between the door and the labor is probably pretty close.
All right. Very good. Well, hope that helps. Let's go on to Effingham next, line four. Hello.
Yes. I'm kind of a naturalist. In this kind of weather, I witnessed here people cutting down their shade trees. And it just seems outrageous. I have good shade on the south side of my house, and I have no shade on the north side until late evening. And the difference is I always walk on the shady side because the concrete and all that and the heat bounces, and it's just horrendous. But previous places I live, I had the house surrounded by trees, shaded totally, morning, evening. And I run, maybe it's a little hotter now, but I ran my air conditioning system, which was universal to, you know, wasn't a window thing. And I would run it about 3 weeks a summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just so taken by that, I thought, and I'm a tree guy, so I would not cut anything until it was dangerous. But an old solid tree, and I've got three maples and an elm, or four maples and an elm on the south side. Good shape. And I just find it to be outrageous when I see those things happen. And then
there's an awful lot of people that don't understand the effects of solar gain. And so, yes, a good shade tree, an older tree, as long as it's not overhanging the house with branches that are wanting to fall down, really will reduce the load on an air conditioner. You're absolutely 100% correct. There are several different things we can do to the house to try and reduce the solar gain or the heat buildup from the sun. But when it gets to, you know, 90 degrees and 90% humidity, there's not much the shade's going to be able to do about taking that moisture and that heat out of there. But definitely for most of the days that we run around this area, a couple of good shade trees make a big difference. I've seen it time in and out where somebody says, hey, I'm going to trim this tree up, and I'm looking at it going, well, if you do, this room may be a little bit warmer and your air conditioning bill may go up. So, yes, you're 100% correct. Unfortunately, it's really difficult to get nice big trees on brand new subdivisions. So when we're building houses, we have to actually build them to where we can put the central air in there and make them energy efficient.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and also one thing that people used to do, at least in some older houses, you can see much wider soffits and much more overhang, and that's amazing how that will help shade your windows and also will help the heating.
Yes, because of the angle of the sun in the summer versus the angle of the sun in the wintertime, the soffits do make a big difference. Not necessarily architecturally pleasing, but definitely very effective for helping keep the house a little bit more temperate.
We will have to leave it at that. I'm sorry, we got one caller we just can't take. But next month, though, Scott will be back and we'll do it again. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, David.
That's Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on this program once a month for these shows we do on home maintenance.
AM 580 thanks Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
We're going to take a break here, as we usually do when we continue with Focus in hour number two. Justin Martin will be with us, and he will talk about his new biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, the great American landscape architect. The book is called Genius of Place. That's in hour number two. First, though, we'll break, as we usually do, for an update on the market, so stay tuned.
Yeah, with this update on the markets, Jay Pierce here, 10:58, the hard red winter wheat for September in Kansas City, trading at 7:51 and a quarter, down 13 and a quarter. December 776 down 13 and 3 quarters, and March at 791 and a half down 12 and 3 quarters. September wheat in Chicago 679 and a quarter down 15 and a half. December at 708 and 3 quarters down 14 and 3 quarters. And the March 2012 wheat at 741 and 3 quarters down 12 and a half. September corn 689 and 3 quarters down 11 and a half. December 669 and 3 quarters down 15. The March contract for 2012, 681 and a quarter down 14. May, 686 and a half down 14. July 2012, corn 619 and a quarter down 14 and a quarter. Soybeans for August, 1381 down 4 and 3 quarters. September, 1377 and 3 quarters down 5 and a quarter. November, 1381 and 3 quarters down 5 and a quarter. January 2012, soybeans 1390 and 3 quarters down 4 and a half. March at 1392 and a quarter down 4 and a quarter. And May 2012, soybeans 1387 down 3 and a quarter. August soybean meal 358.20 down 210. September 360.10 down 2 even. And the soybean oil for August, 56.90, down 45. September, 57.12, down 44. Live cattle for August, 110.25, down 35. October, 116.10, down 75. August feeder cattle, 135, down 70. And September, 136.12 and a half, down 67 and a half. The August lean hogs at 97.70, currently down 125. And the October lean hogs.